Today on the Undivided Podcast, America has a moral consistency problem and we can't move forward until we fix it. Plus, President Biden says he cares about the rising cost for American families, but why is he trying so hard to deflect blame? And another congressional Republican exposed as a complete hypocrite about former President Donald Trump.
You know, he plays the TV game, and he went too far.
And finally, comparing and contrasting Seattle and New York City, the two places are mentioned frequently together when it comes to the state of politics and social issues like crime and homelessness, but is one of the cities truly worse off?
And I do feel like, in some way, it is better managed.
Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Welcome to the Undivided Podcast. I'm Bryony Cruz. Thank you so much for listening. I'm actually in New York City today. I have a friend who moved out to New York City from Seattle during the pandemic. I hadn't been out to visit yet, so I came out for a little visit. And it's interesting because Seattle and New York City are talked a lot about in the same conversations when it comes to progressive cities and the state of progressive cities and crime and disorder and politics gone awry. And, you know, I have a few observations about that, I think, about comparisons or contrasts that I would draw between Seattle and New York City. I spent a lot of time yesterday walking all around, seeing how the city is coming back to life post-pandemic. So I'm actually going to, my friend who, again, was in the Navy, we went to college together, so best friends for like more than a decade, 15 years or so, was in the Navy, came to Seattle to live with me after the Navy, and then ended up staying there for several years and decided to move to New York City during the pandemic. I'm going to have him at the end of the podcast come in and talk about some of his observations from, he lived on Capitol Hill during the Chaz Chop experiment. And it was like right after that, a year later, that he moved to New York City. So I wanted to have him give some observations about the political climate in both cities and whether they're really as similar as some, I think, conservative media, for instance, lumps them together in some of the same conversations. And so I'm going to pick his brain about whether he thinks that those comparisons are fair. So that's coming up later in the podcast. But first, if I've said it once, I've said it a million times. I do not believe that this country can get back on track and that we can bridge political divides until we all start putting actions before affiliation, until we show some moral consistency in the way that we judge people, in the way that we judge people's actions. And when I say actions before affiliation, I mean, to me, when you have, you know, you've set your moral compass and you're going to stay the course, you judge someone based on their actions rather than and without any consideration for their political affiliations. But too often in this country, the media in particular, and then political partisans, hyper-partisans, we tend to be more forgiving of bad behavior when it's someone on our end of the political spectrum or who we agree with politically than we are and judge people on the other end much more harshly for the same kind of behavior. I think that that's damaging. I think it's erosive for our political and public discourse. And an example this week that just really got me off on a bender was the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot. So Lori Lightfoot responded to the likely reversal of Roe from the Supreme Court, and she sent out a tweet. To my friends in the LGBTQ plus community, the Supreme Court is coming for us next. This moment has to be a call to arms. Let's break that down for a second. So first, she's repeating something that we've heard a lot from folks on the left as it pertains to the abortion debate, is they believe if you have the Supreme Court that overturns precedent in this manner, that other things could be next. We talked about this on the podcast last week about how Representative Eric Swalwell was like, oh, they're going to come for interracial marriage. And he also brought up gay rights. And so I know that there are a lot of folks who are concerned that an erosion of abortion rights could lead to an erosion of gay rights. And then they're saying it could also lead to an erosion of the ability to marry outside of your race, which I think is absurd. Now, I understand, you know, some of the concerns and real fears around a possible erosion of gay rights because you have something like abortion that's been the law of the land, you know, Roe v. Wade, that's been the law of the land for such a long time. And so could something similar happen with gay marriage where you thought you had this right in place and now it's going to be eroded or walked back? But I do believe that there's a little fear-mongering going on with that. And like I said on the podcast last week, it's kind of like just one issue at a time, okay? Let's deal with the debate and what's going to happen with Roe and then see where it goes from there. We'll talk more about this in a minute. But the real issue I had with Lori Lightfoot's tweet was her saying, this moment has to be a call to arms. Given her city's immense challenges with shootings and murders, not sure call to arms is the best phrasing for her to make, but my larger issue was, and I made this argument on Twitter, can you imagine if Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, just as an example, had made a call to arms during the parental rights debate, what the media called the Don't Say Gay bill, had made a call to arms to parents to protect their rights when it comes to their child's education? Just imagine, and do so honestly, how the media would have responded to Governor Ron DeSantis saying that. Yeah, it would have been calling for his resignation. And I think it would have been right to be critical. It's right to be critical of any politicians who's making a call to arms, especially after January 6th. Words matter. Words matter when you're someone who's an elected leader, and you have to really consider how someone who's on the fringe or who's not stable might take your words and use them to their own, you know, in their own sick and twisted way. So when I've got Lori Lightfoot, Democrat, anti-gun, who's got people shot and killed in her city all the time, who's making a call to arms on the abortion debate, saying it's going to erode LGBTQ rights, that's concerning. From a moral standpoint for me, if I'm judging actions without any care or consideration for affiliation, that's concerning. Yet it clearly didn't get the sort of outrage that it would have had a Republican said that. And not only that, the number of people making excuses for what Lori Lightfoot said because of her affiliation, not because of what she actually said, is really alarming to me. It's incredibly disappointing. So again, when I got on Twitter and I asked people to consider how this would have been received had Ron DeSantis said it, for instance, all these Democrats who got my mentions defending her and saying I was overreacting, you really think that they would have done that if it had been a Republican to say it? One Twitter user wrote, this is definitely going to mobilize all those pro-choice, quasi-militant organizations that have been training in the desert waiting for the day to take up arms against the government. Yep, exactly the same thing. So suggesting that, well, people on the left don't own guns and they're not training in the desert to take up arms against the government, as if that's a very normal thing for Republicans that they do all the time. It's really quite absurd. And a similar response here. The issue is if the conservatives call to arms, it will be for real. Oh, so Lori Lightfoot, we should just know that her call to arms is definitely not legitimate, and crazy people who are all spun into a rage thinking that LGBTQ rights are going to be eroded are definitely not going to take that literally because people on the left can't own guns. I mean, may I remind you of Seattle's Chaz Chop experiment where you had people with AR-15 rifles that were given to them out of the trunk of a car patrolling a 6-block neighborhood in the city of Seattle? Oh, and that those people shot and killed someone? I mean, let's be honest here. To suggest that it's only people on the right who own guns and who can be irresponsible with guns is absolutely absurd. Another response, nice try, Brandy, deflecting as usual. Deflecting from what? Deflecting from what? I'm judging her words and her actions. And I don't care what her affiliation is. And if you had a Republican who was saying the same kind of bullshit, I would say the same thing. I'm not deflecting from anything. But again, this is what happens when we don't have a moral standard and instead we look at someone's politics when we decide whether their behavior is acceptable or not. I truly do believe it's one of the biggest issues facing this country, and it's one of the biggest problems with the press as well, is the press most certainly has two different standards in this country. They have the standard that they hold Republicans to and the standard that they hold Democrats to. They have the standard that they cover protests and riots for left causes to, and they have the standard that they hold protests and riots by people on the right too. And those standards are much, much different. It's actually something, Sunday coming up on the Undivided Digital Show, I'm going to be speaking with Julio Rosas. He's a journalist and senior writer for Town Hall. He's a conservative journalist, and he is the author of a new book called Fiery But Mostly Peaceful, The 2020 Riots and the Gaslighting of America. And he talks about his experience covering riots across the country, including in Seattle and Minneapolis, and Kenosha during the 2020 riots following the murder of George Floyd. And the title of his book, Fiery But Mostly Peaceful, refers to a CNN report where you had the correspondent who was standing in front of burning buildings and cars. And on the screen, the CNN, what we call a chyron, said fiery but mostly peaceful protests. And again, had you had, just look at the Capitol riot, for instance, you would have never had, if you had a riot being carried out by people on the right, where the correspondent is standing in front of burned out buildings, you would have never had CNN call it fiery, but mostly peaceful. And so I'm going to air this interview I did with Julio Rosas Sunday on the digital show, but I just wanted to give you a sneak peek of that part of our conversation about the moral inconsistency problem we have in America. I worry about Americans because if you've got, you know, CNN one day, they've got burned out cars and vehicles behind them calling it fiery, but mostly peaceful. And then fast forward, you've got talking heads on MSNBC calling the January 6th riot worse than 9/11. I mean, do you think there's been any introspection by the mainstream media about just how hypocritical their coverage of all of that was?
No. And we're seeing it playing out right now with this whole Roe versus Wade situation. And you know, obviously I wrote and finished all this way before this all happened. But again, we're seeing just yesterday I was at a protest. It was peaceful, but it was at a protest at Justice Alito's house over here in Virginia. And, you know, there's, from my point of view, non-legal expert, that's technically breaking that law, that statute to not intimidate judges. And yet, Jen Psaki just today was saying, well, as long as it remains peaceful, we encourage this type of thing. And it's they're making excuses again. And it's not just, you know, Democrats, but again, I've written for Town Hall recently all these kind of examples of people within the media, you know, justifying or excusing or putting in context these protests at Supreme Court justices' homes to intimidate them to change their ruling. And so, no, they haven't learned because, I mean, was anyone fired with CNN for that chyron? You know, Ali Velshi is still, you know, at MSNBC, and all these reporters who downplayed these riots, especially in the aftermath of January 6th, no one took anything from it. And so, of course, I mean, there's so much hubris, and there's so much inflated sense of self-importance that they think that no one can touch them. And that is kind of true, right? I mean, because there's just no media accountability. So when there's no accountability, they're just going to run the same playbook all over again.
And I will say the January 6th riot, on the flip side, you know, there are conservatives who try to downplay the seriousness of that as well. And to me, it just undercut the frustration that they had expressed for so long with the left downplaying the riots that happened in the summer of 2020. Do you feel like the right has been hard enough on those who participated in January 6th?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about, like, I provide an example in the book when I talk about my coverage of January 6th, because initially a lot of people, some people on the right were wanting to blame Antifa for it, and Antifa infiltrators, BLM infiltrators. And there was that one case of John Sullivan, who was a BLM activist from Utah. But as I explained, that one of the big reasons you can tell that this wasn't, by and large, you know, Antifa individuals is because a lot of people who entered the Capitol, they didn't wear face coverings. As someone who's dealt with Antifa, I'm sure a lot in Seattle, they do a very good job. They take painstaking measures to hide their identity because they don't want to be caught so they can continue out doing things. These people, on the other hand, didn't wear face coverings. They didn't hide their identities. And looking through the indictments and looking out through all these people, a lot of these people who, you know, broke in or were let in, like that one door, which is weird, by the way, but they were Trump supporters. And so for me, from my perspective, it's just, look, this is why it's so hard as a country to address these issues, because when we look at how the left, you know, is trying to portray and justify the riots, and how, you know, some on the right are trying to downplay January 6th, they were riots.
Again, that's part of my conversation with Julio Rosas, senior writer for townhall.com, author of the new book, Fiery But Mostly Peaceful, The 2020 Riots and the Gaslighting of America. We're going to have that full interview coming up for you Sunday on the Undivided Digital Show. You can watch that by becoming a paid subscriber. It's at patreon.com/undivided or on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. We talk about a lot of things, including his experience covering Chaz Chop, the occupied protest zone in Seattle, and his experience experience getting shot with a rubber bullet straight in the chest by the Minneapolis Police Department, and how he's recovering from that ordeal. So it was a fascinating interview, great perspective on what it was like for him to be on the ground across the country in 2020. So I hope you'll watch that interview. But I thought we had an interesting conversation about moral inconsistency when it comes to political unrest in this country. One of the single biggest issues facing the country right now, it is leading to the erosion of our political institutions. It has led to the erosion of our public discourse. And this is an issue that is contingent on all of us to really commit ourselves to fixing. And all we can do is control ourselves. That's the only thing we can do. And so you really have to try to force yourself to look at things through a consistent moral lens and decide, again, what's the phrase? Actions before affiliation, to commit to judging people and institutions based on their actions without any care or consideration for their affiliation. It's the only way out of this place that we're in as a country. I want to talk about the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. And specifically, I want to have a conversation about cash out refis. This is something more and more people are considering. I spoke with Rich Hunt, the founder of 1530 Mortgage, about cash out refis and about who might benefit from one. Is it okay if you're somebody who's struggling financially to do a cash out refi to help you get by, or is that not a good use of that?
No, I would say it was probably the best use of it. It's a strategy that basically is going to let you get out of debt, and you're using your home to do that. It would be nice to save some money and put something away rather than give it to the banks and their high interest credit card debt.
So if you're interested in a cash out refi, or maybe you just have some questions about it to see if it's right for you, give my friends at 1530 Mortgage a call, 206-207-7777. Tell them you heard about them on the Undivided podcast. You can also visit them at 1530mortgage.com. 1530 Mortgage, NMLS ID 1761573, equal housing opportunity. For informational purposes only, not an offer to extend credit. Credit approval required. Information and or dates are subject to change without notice. Not available in all states. Certain programs may not be eligible. Other restrictions may apply. We need to have a really honest conversation about President Biden's messaging around the cost increases that are facing American families. I mean, let's be honest, and I'll be frank with you. You know, I am comfortable financially. You know, even though I quit my job, I feel like I'm still okay financially. And so, you know, and especially when I was at Fox for all those years, I made great money and I never really, it had been a long time. Let's say this. It had been a long time since I stood at the gas pump, gassed up my car and was really concerned about how much the gas was and about the cost of that. You know, I grew up lower middle class, and certainly growing up, I recall my family putting like $5 in, or my dad, he'd put like, you know, 1 gallon of gas in. And so I had those experiences. And certainly, and I think most like college kids have that experience regardless of how you grew up. If you're kind of on your own in college where you're like, okay, I'm going to put $10 in the gas tank. But that is, and I think having those experiences, you know, allows me to recognize and realize that that is the reality for many, many Americans at the gas pump, where there is an anxiety around how much they can afford to put in. Are they going to be able to afford enough gas to get their kids where they need to go for the day, to be able to go to and from work, and to see gas prices as they are? You have to be able to recognize, as a politician in particular, how impactful a 50% hike in gas prices, or even 5% week over week, can be for so many Americans. And so, you know, I was talking about my own personal experience, and even recently, even though, you know, I feel like, okay, I'm going to be able to be fine with the cost of gas, this past week, I mean, gosh, it was like $5.15, and this was one of the first times that I've really sat at the gas pump and been like, oh gosh, like how much am I going to have to pay for this? It was like $70 to fill up my tank, and it was really, I was like really taking note of it, how expensive it's going to continue to be. And so it really got me thinking about and feeling very empathetic for Americans who are dealing with that in a very, very profound way. You know, I'm lucky enough to work for myself now, and so I'm not driving into Seattle every single day and driving back home like an hour round trip. And so if I needed to stay home, I could stay home. That is not the case for many, many people who are really struggling and suffering right now. And so it's bothersome to me when you have politicians who are wealthy, haven't had to concern themselves with finances for a long time, who are incapable of empathizing with what so many Americans are dealing with. And, you know, it was back when Putin invaded Ukraine. And yeah, you know, gas prices, I do agree that gas prices have jumped a lot in part because of Putin, certainly not in its entirety. I mean, gas prices were already going up before the invasion of Ukraine. But when you had political pundits and talking heads and politicians who are like, you know, if we have to pay a little more at the pump in order to cut off Putin's funding for his military, then so be it. It's like, but that's easy for you to say if you're not suffering, if you're not wondering how you're going to get from point A to point B. And so there's that disconnect that really exists there between the political class, insular media, and just what regular folks are dealing with every single day. And so I become very frustrated with Biden's messaging on these issues, you know, the cost of groceries and the cost of gas and inflation. And what feels like his desire to first and foremost distance himself from these problems, as opposed to focus like a laser on how to fix them. There's always that messaging of, okay, let me first figure out how to spin this so no one blames me, and then we can get to work trying to address them. It's just so cowardly to me. It's like, okay, I know whatever you're concerned about politics, but people are concerned with how they're going to afford groceries for their families and how they're going to be able to afford gas to get to and from work. Like, this isn't about you, Mr. President. This isn't about you protecting your reputation or trying to distance yourself from a political loss in a midterm election year. You're the president of the United States. Your primary concern should be about the suffering of Americans, about these real issues. And so, you know, I see these things and how the president tries to spin this. So May 11th, he tweets, he was giving some remarks. He said, "Tune in as I deliver remarks on Putin's price hike and our actions to support farmers and food processors, lower their costs, and lower prices for families." Okay, so I'm glad you're going to speak about your actions to lower costs, but, you know, again, look at how he tries to distance himself from any culpability of it. Tune in as I deliver remarks on Putin's price hike. That's clear messaging that's meant to gaslight Americans. Now, again, do I believe the Russian invasion of Ukraine is contributing to the rise in gas prices? Of course I do. But I also know that gas prices were on the increase before then, and there's a lot of other issues as it pertains to the amount of money that Americans are putting out for basic essentials every single month that has nothing to do with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but he is a convenient scapegoat. And again, you have to remember, we're in a midterm election year, a very critical one for Democrats that isn't shaping up well for them. So of course they're trying to spin these things to distance blame. And not only to distance blame, but to put blame on other people, including Republicans. For instance, another tweet from the president. This is, again, May 11th. "While it is heartening to see that annual inflation moderated in April, the fact remains that inflation is unacceptably high and bringing it down is my top economic priority." That's a great tweet. Okay, no excuses, no deflection. Oh, but the tweet's not over. He went on to say, "My plan will lower costs. Meanwhile, congressional Republicans' only plan is to raise taxes on families." Okay. So if your plan is to lower costs, great, let's put that plan in action, because clearly that's not working. And congressional Republicans' only plan is to raise taxes on families. They're not even in power right now. They're not responsible for any of this. You can't blame any of this on congressional Republicans. It's just amazing to me, and it worries me how many people might buy into that narrative. Again, another tweet, May 10th, from the President of the United States. "I happen to think it's a good thing when American families have more money in their pockets at the end of the month. But Republicans in Congress don't seem to think so. Their plan is going to make working families poorer." Dude, working families, I shouldn't call the president dude. Mr. President, working families are poorer under your administration. It's, again, this fear-mongering of this is exactly what he's trying to do. Fear-monger Americans into thinking that if Republicans win, if they take the House or the Senate in the 2022 midterms, that things are going to be worse for working families. Things are bad for working families now. It bothers me that the president or his team or who's ever tweeting that has so little respect for us that they would try to spin things in that way, that they would try to make this an issue of Democrats versus Republicans as opposed to an issue of how can we help working families right now under this administration. This is so bad. It just continues. May 10th. And this is all in the last couple days. So he's just beating the drum on this issue. May 10th, the president tweets out, "The bottom line is this. There are two paths reflecting two very different sets of values." So he has a tweet laying out his path. My plan attacks inflation and grows our economy by lowering costs for working families, giving workers a well-deserved raise, reducing the deficit by historic levels, making big corporations and the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share. So again, he's saying his plan lowers costs for working families. When are we going to see that plan? And then the next tweet, he says, the ultra-mega plan put forth by congressional Republicans will raise taxes on working families, lower the incomes of workers, threaten Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, give big corporations and billionaires break after break. So again, he's trying to paint these pictures of what life would be like under Republicans while completely fantasizing or ignoring about what life is like under him right now. That's not right. When you're a leader, and we were led to believe that President Biden is a leader that has a lot of empathy for people, and I think he's shown tremendous empathy at times when it's really mattered, but you have to have empathy over people who are struggling right now under your administration and are doing worse today than they were the day that you took office. Without excuses, without deflection, just stepping up and saying, look, I'm the president. Every problem in this country is my problem. Every problem you have is my problem. And I'm not going to blame anyone else. I'm not going to deflect. I am going to be laser focused on how to make it better. And that is going to be my only care or consideration, not the outcome of the 2022 midterms. That's the person that I think a lot of people thought Joe Biden could be or would be, that he was really in tune to the working class, to the middle class, that he wasn't absorbed with hyper-partisan politics. And look, I know for Democrats, losing the midterms would be a big blow. I think they are on track to lose the midterms. And honestly, that's what happens, right, in an off election year. That's what happens when you're the party in power during the midterms. You don't do as well. And that's what's going to happen this time around, probably to a larger extent because of all the issues happening in this country. It's really unavoidable. The only thing you can control is what's happening in the country right now and how Americans are doing, how they're feeling, how they're surviving, how they're getting by. Please, Mr. President, put the partisan politics aside in this one term that you have. And yes, he's only going to have one term. He's not going to run again, no matter what he says. Just focus on helping Americans get through this really tough period of time, regardless of political ramifications, regardless of whether you can push blame off onto someone else. Just help the people who you ran to help. It really is that simple. Another observation on the issue of moral consistency and moral courage. Remember there's that book coming out by the two New York Times journalists, and they've been slowly leaking these audio tapes and these revelations leading up to, I think their book has now been released, but they've been pushing things out slowly, you know, to try to gain press. And one of the last big blockbusters they released was Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, who was talking with Liz Cheney on the phone about how he wanted to encourage President Trump to resign after January 6th.
Are you hearing that he might resign? Is there any reason to think that might happen?
My gut tells me no. I'm seriously thinking of having that conversation with him tonight. I haven't talked to him in a couple days. What I think I'm going to do is I'm going to call him, and it would be my recommendation he should resign.
Well, now these New York Times journalists have leaked another bit of audio, and it is Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. And in this audio, Lindsey Graham, this is again in reference to January 6th, Lindsey Graham is praising Joe Biden and criticizing former President Donald Trump.
Moments like this reset. It'll take a while. People have calmed down. I don't want to be associated with that. This is a group within a group. And what this does, there'll be a rallying effect for a while. The country says we're better than this.
And Biden will help that, right?
Yeah, totally. He'll be maybe the best person to have, right? I mean, how bad can you get it, Joe Biden?
Now, there are certainly times where Lindsey Graham has been critical of Donald Trump, but not near the extent that he was in that leaked audio. It's one thing to be politically courageous when you think no one is listening. But when you turn around and act completely differently in public, that just makes you a coward. And the only reason Lindsey Graham wouldn't say those sorts of things publicly is because he was worried about the political ramifications of it. He was worried about getting on former President Donald Trump's bad side, the same way House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy was. For him to say behind the scenes that he wanted to ask the president to resign and then defend and try to diminish and downplay what happened publicly. It is political cowardice to the extreme, regardless of, and you could be listening to this and love former President Donald Trump, but I can't imagine that you love the fact that you'd have Republicans who defended Trump publicly, but behind the scenes, they were talking shit about him. Behind the scenes, they were talking about how he should resign, how Joe Biden is better than him, how we're going to get through this period of time. So again, it has nothing to do with your feelings about former President Donald Trump and everything to do with the expectation that politicians would be courageous enough to say what they really feel to people's faces and to say so publicly, as opposed to cowering behind the scenes with one completely different narrative than they're giving to the public, than they're giving to the press. You know, and that's why I go back to Liz Cheney. I know there's some Republicans and pro-Trump Republicans who just hate Liz Cheney because she talks smack about the president. She's very blunt about how she feels about the former president. But at least she had the courage to say so publicly. You know, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois is another one. You might not like either of them because they were so hard on the president. They've sided with Democrats on issues like the January 6th Commission. And like Mitt Romney is another example. People who voted to impeach the former president. At least they voted their conscience. At least they said out loud what they were actually thinking. As opposed to other Republicans who, what, lied to you? Lied to the public? And then went squirrely behind the scenes and gossiped? I would take 10 times out of 10, someone who was honest to me, even if I didn't agree with their honesty, even if I didn't agree with their opinion or their perspective. And that's why if you follow Seattle politics, there's a councilwoman, a socialist, Shamba Sawant, and she's, you probably know who she is, even if you don't live here, because she's been talked about nationally a lot. You know, Shamba Sawant is out there. She is as fringe gets. But I'll take Shamba Sawant over other members of the council who aren't honest. I know what I'm going to get from Shamba Sawant 100% of the time, and she doesn't deviate. I'd rather take predictability and honesty, even if I find it abhorrent at times. I'd much prefer that over someone who cannot find the courage to say what they really mean out loud. So again, shame on Lindsey Graham, shame on Kevin McCarthy. And although I don't like this tactic and these New York Times writers who wrote this book and are just like leaking out these really important revelations leading up to the midterms. I don't like that tactic. I think if you have news as a journalist, you should put news out there. I still think that we've learned some very interesting things about who people really are behind the scenes from some of the things that they've uncovered. Okay, I told you we're going to end the podcast today talking to a friend of mine. I'm in New York City for a few days. We'll still have the podcast and everything as usual. In fact, I'm looking out at the city right now from my friend's apartment. My friend Johnny has been my best friend for 15 years. Again, we went to college together at the University of Nebraska. He went off, joined the Navy. He was stationed over near Tokyo in Yokosuka, Japan. And then afterwards, he came to live with me in Seattle just to sort of land on his feet. He went to grad school and ended up staying there for several years, lived on Capitol Hill during Chaz Chop and all of that, and then decided during the pandemic to move to New York City. And I thought I'd have him in just to talk a little bit about comparing and contrasting the political environments in the two cities and also just the social environments, you know, homelessness and drug abuse and crime and all those things and his perspective on both of those things. Welcome to the Undivided Podcast, my friend.
Hello, Brandy Cruz.
Thanks for hosting me in New York City. Very exciting. It's been nice. We walked, how many steps did we get in yesterday?
About 21,000.
So I feel like I'm already an expert on New York City because I took 20,000 steps around it.
You're back in the Big Apple. Actually, the first time I visited New York City was to visit you when you were interning here in what, 2011?
Yeah, I was an intern for CBS and was very poor and had to leave the city. And then I moved to Seattle to take a job at Cairo Radio. So you lived on Capitol Hill when you left Seattle.
I did. So I was on arguably the edge of Capitol Hill. I was on 12th and Jackson, kind of when all the, you know, craziness of that summer happened.
For you, because you were also up there during the pandemic. So there were a few things going on. We had this summer of unrest that was really happening kind of in your backyard. And then we had the pandemic going on. But these are conversations we've had between each other as friends. But I just thought they were fascinating because you really experienced the deterioration of that particular part of Seattle.
Obviously, it started with the pandemic, right? It definitely seemed a bit like a ghost town. And once you clear away the normalcy of everyday life, it really highlights some of the issues that were taking place there. You know, the folks who were, you know, abusing substances, and the people experiencing homelessness as well, is something that was really highlighted after you peel away that normalcy.
And to be fair, and I think we could say this, you're more liberal than me, more progressive than me on a lot of things.
Correct. And we've, you know, over the years have had many
a political disagreement over drinks.
Alcohol-induced debates, yes, that have led to, you know, some very chaotic discussions, maybe.
Yeah, but I think you're the good, that's why you're a perfect person to have this conversation with, because we have differences of opinion on some political things, but there were still a lot of frustrations for you living up on Capitol Hill. And I remember one instance in particular where you and your boyfriend were at a coffee shop and you'd been like repeatedly harassed there, right?
Correct. So we would do our mornings, you know, morning walks and go out to coffee. And, you know, that's about all you could do in that neighborhood at the time during the pandemic. So we'd get our coffee and we'd sit outside at the coffee shop there under the little patio that they had built up during the pandemic. And, you know, there's the normal folks that would walk around there, you know, people loud and yelling. It's what makes Capitol Hill unique.
Special. Yes.
You know, it's always something, if you visit or you live there, it's just something you're used to and it's just part of the territory, right? But as I was stating earlier, once you peel away that normalcy, those issues seem to have gotten a lot worse. It definitely made it not a safe place to be. And particularly the incident that you're talking about, we were literally verbally harassed, told that we were going to be murdered. My boyfriend, who is Japanese, was like called racial slurs. I mean, it's not like it was like a final straw or anything. I live on Capitol Hill. I loved Capitol Hill. It's my neighborhood. It's the gayborhood. It's fun. You always need a couch to crash on when you'd come up and party there. You know?
Yes, so. We have definitely some good outings at the gay bars.
Exactly. So, I mean, Capitol Hill is my home. So it's not like, oh, you know, all these new problems are forcing me to move out or leave or anything. But it's definitely something that we have to be able to talk about because it is a problem.
It right? is. And you can't act like it's not. I mean, you know, that experience at the coffee shop, you can't diminish that and be like, oh, well, it's someone suffering. And that's true. Like, it's obviously was someone who was mentally ill, maybe substance abuse issues.
Correct. And that's why, I mean, I was really angry when it happened. And, you know, you get that kind of fight or flight response, right? Of like, should I yell back and stand up for myself? But when somebody is so in the depths of whether it be addiction or whatever problems they're facing, you can't rationalize with a person who's like that.
Yeah. So. But I think what bothers me is like people, and I think more so the activist class in Seattle, have convinced folks that you can't just be honest about the fact that that's frustrating. That's scary. That's not right. It's not fair for people who live there to be treated like that, to have to deal with that, for businesses to have to deal with that. And I feel like we get in these echo chambers where it's like either you're sympathetic towards the homeless and the drug addicted and mentally ill, or you're sympathetic towards businesses and towards like you're a NIMBY, where it's like, no, I deserve to feel safe in my neighborhood and businesses deserve to be able to operate safely.
Yeah, and like you stated earlier, like I do consider myself progressive, but you have to be able, like you can't solve problems if you're not able to talk about them,
correct?
Right? And I know that a lot of people, my friends across all socioeconomic status, across all ethnicities, you know, all different types of people, you know how large our and diverse our friend group is in Seattle. And a lot of us felt the same way, right? We can't talk about these problems without being, you know, harassed, or you're immediately put into one corner. Like, if I'm talking about the problems that exist on Capitol Hill, I'm immediately a Trump supporter. And that is, couldn't be farther from the truth.
Oh, and you've laughed at like how many people have called me right wing and stuff over the years. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know.
Which, I mean, really in any other city, let's be honest, you're just a pretty textbook moderate,
yeah.
Right? But in Seattle, when you pick apart some issues on, you know, policy that heightens crime or does those types of things in Seattle, and I'm not saying that it's completely wrong, some of the policies going on there, but you have to talk about things for them to get better, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about your move to New York City, because yes. So this happened during the pandemic. I think on conservative media in particular, there's a lot of comparisons that happen between Seattle and New York City, because they're held up as like these progressive bastions that are just crumbling, right? So did you have a certain perspective? Because you'd been in Seattle for, what, 7 years?
Almost seven years.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the city got worse from when you moved in to when you left?
There's absolutely no denying that.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct, it got
and
worse.
And so did you have any particular expectations or perspectives of what New York City would be like to live in based on, like, media coverage or the issues that were happening here?
Well, I honestly made a very rash COVID decision to upend my entire life and move across the country. You know, you see the news that's going on, you know, all the protests and, you know, the similar issues of businesses being broken into, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't something that was keeping me away from moving to the city. You know, it's growing up in America, you know, living in New York City is kind of like the end all be all. It's like you've made it in life, right? Mm-hmm. If you move here. And I wanted to experience that. So the news and the things that, you know, I would read, it didn't keep me away from moving here.
Yeah. I'm going to get into the details in a second, but just quick answer. Is Seattle or New York City kind of worse off, do you think?
Ooh. I mean,
like quality of life.
It's apples to oranges. It really is. Okay. I mean, this is how I kind of describe it, you know, to all my Seattle crew who I'm still really good friends with. And it's just that New York City is just so busy being like one of the world's most diverse cities that there is no time to just sit in virtue signal constantly. There's too much humanity taking place here and people going about their daily lives just trying to make life work. And in Seattle, we were talking about this yesterday, actually. Seattle is just such a big tech community that a lot of people, you know, are kind of sitting in their high castles, virtue signaling about what things should be done while they're making $250,000 a year.
Yeah, there's like a lot of petty debates happening in Seattle that there's just not the time for it in New York City. There's too much going on that it would get lost.
Agreed, yes.
You know, we walked around a lot yesterday, mm-hmm. and it had been several years since I'd been in New York City. I felt much safer walking around in New York City than I would on Capitol Hill or downtown Seattle.
You know, and I don't know what I'm no policy expert on New York City politics, right? I've only lived here for a year and I just, you know, do my daily due diligence of reading the news. So I'm no policy expert, but they seem to have figured out the homelessness issue here a little better than in Seattle, but it does feel safer. I will say there are definitely pain points.
Yeah, there are definitely issues here.
One, the subway has gotten really terrible. You know, you just had the shooting that happened in Brooklyn. You have a lot of Asian hate still going on in here, which is really terrible. So there's still definitely issues taking place. But I will say, just walking around, and maybe it feels that way because it's a busier city in general, but it does feel safer. And I remember mentioning that to you when I moved here. I said, you know, I do feel safer just walking around New York City.
Well, an example, we spent a lot of time in Central Park yesterday. If that was Seattle, it would be a homeless camp. There's just no question in my mind. Like, every open park space in Seattle is or has been at some point just a homeless community.
In Seattle's defense, I think you can go to Volunteer Park, and that one is a comparable in beauty and safety to Central Park.
Okay, because Central Park's a huge park. I didn't see a single homeless tent. There'd certainly be a lot of places for them to be.
But I don't know if it's because they just have more shelter beds, or maybe they're more strict with their sweeping policies.
I do know that they have a more robust shelter system in New York City. It's been an issue in the past. So I think just, you know, when you look at, again, and I think conservative media tends to focus on it more just because of the narrative of it. When you look at the comparisons that are made between Seattle and New York City, politically speaking and social issues, do you really think there's any comparison to be made?
I think there's comparisons to be made, being that, you know, New York City has a large upper middle class with people who make good money, well-educated. I mean, you have some of the best educational institutions in the country and in the world here. Same with Seattle, right? So there's a lot of comparisons to draw there. But New York is just so much more diverse. And there's just like a much larger chance of actual problems happening here. And I do feel like in some way it is better managed.
One of the things I really take away from this conversation, and I didn't think about it before, is
Seattle has so much insular political drama that just gets lost in the, would get lost in the hustle and bustle of New York City. Like, the activist class in Seattle has so much clout and such a voice where I don't think that they would be able to have the same influence here.
Well, and I think that maybe goes back to the diversity point I was trying to make before, is that it's so diverse here that it's hard for, like, one voice to reign supreme in city politics.
Sure, that makes sense. Well, Johnny, my best friend, I love having you on the podcast. It's very fun. So we're going to wrap up today's podcast and then probably go drink
or something. Try to rein it in until maybe 3 or 4 p.m.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Brandy.
That's it for this episode of the Undivided Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for making a commitment to not only, as we say, giving common sense a comeback, but to acting with moral consistency. It is so key to moving forward as a country. If you have not already, consider becoming an Undivided subscriber at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. And thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.